All right, I'm going to try something because it's a Halloween episode. So I'm going to do our introduction in a horror way. All right.
Okay, good ready? Luck with that.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Welcome to the Collected Edition, a horrific podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the gruesome history of comics. I'm Ghoul Matthew Carr, and with me as always is Brain Reese.
I'm going to leave the voice to you, but here I am. And a spectacular week to you, Mr. Carr.
Yes, this should be, if all goes well.
Paul Carr, the Crypt Keeper.
It was my Bela Lugosi. It was actually more of the Count from Sesame Street, if I'm honest. That's right. One introduction. Anywho.
Two people doing podcasts.
This should be released on Halloween, so... all of this will be in context, I guess. So anyway, welcome to the Collected Edition, everybody. I'm Paul. That's Brian over there. And we are going to talk about The Living Mummy, the 1970s reboot of the classic Universal horror type thing. Boy, I should have written that down.
Well done, Paul.
Anyway, but before we get into that, this is going so well already. Before we get into that, there are a couple of things happening in comics that we'd like to discuss. Mostly, this week, it's going to be me complaining. Because Marvel has announced, and there's not a lot to go on, so I'm not going to get too keyed up over it, but the addition of a new character called Manslaughter. This is the Weapon
X. The House of Ideas, ladies and gentlemen.
The House of Ideas from 1995. Yes, this is the Weapon X version of Man-Thing. I have a particular fondness for the character of Man-Thing, and I have a feeling that I'm not going to have a particular fondness for this one.
Well, everybody's Man-Thing is different.
Yes, yes. Okay, so you've seen the picture, haven't you, Brian?
I saw the picture. I tried to do a little bit of research. I've been on vacation down in Mississippi for a while, so I have been out of touch with my funny book news, so I had to research this, and I did see the picture of Man-Slaughter.
Yes, ooh. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's a thing. It's a picture of sort of Man-Thing with bullet bandoliers and a helmet on that says burn, because, you know. By the way, when your Man-Thing burns, you really should see a doctor.
Very, very important.
Yes.
The more you know.
Okay. Yes. I did another podcast called Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast. So, of course, my Twitter feed was inundated with pictures of this and people asking my opinion.
Well, isn't it holding a bunch of machine guns, or the picture I saw?
Yeah, he's holding a gigantic gun with a minigun type of
thing. It also looks like it has muscles. You said 1995, and it's also drawn as if it's this big muscular, that whole style, the Rob Liefeld, and not just Rob Liefeld wasn't the only
was the most egregious
But, it's the Man-Thing is he looks all muscled up. And I was he's a plant.
Right. Yes.
Or it's a plant.
Hey, it's a he. It's definitely a he.
It's a plant.
Yeah, it's not only that. I mean, he's got little wooden spikes coming out of him.
It looks quite silly, but you have a stronger attachment, as you've just referenced or prefaced with. So tell us, Paul, how do you feel?
Well, first of all, in the solicitation, there's not a lot of information on this. It seems as if they're going to do a kind of a retcon of Ted Salas's origin story. All right. So just to give everyone a little bit of background, in the original Man-Thing, the scientist Ted Salas was trying to recreate the super soldier serum of Steve Rogers, Captain America. This all goes awry. He gets injected with it, merges with the swamp, becomes Man-Thing.
Right.
They're going to retcon this into he's working for the Weapon X program. And the way the solicitation was that he's no longer just a man, not a thing. He's all American soil. And he's reporting for duty.
Oh.
I know. Isn't that just awful?
Oh, that's awful.
I know. I know.
Oh. Man.
Yeah.
That makes my head hurt.
Okay, so my feelings on this. The thing that bothers me most about it is it's not that they're trying new things. You know, we talk about on this program all the time, you know, it's good to try new things. It's good to have alternate takes. And I truly am fine with that. I think my real problem is that there's a complete disregard for what the character stands for. In the original Gerber run, Man-Thing he's a creature of pure empathy. He has no mind, no ego, and he feels what others feel. And because of that, he protects the less fortunate. He defends against oppressors. And he's also the guardian of the nexus of all realities. He's the literal protector of all places and all things. This comic seems to pose him as a soldier in the employ of the United States, a single country in a single space, you know, with guns. And that kind of goes against everything he stands for or everything he was created to be. And, you know, how do I tell you this?
But it's edgy.
It is edgy. It is very edgy. But when you do this sort of thing with Batman, for instance, just because we had recently talked about they're going to have a new Batman.
Right.
Batman has half a century of history with hundreds of stories and dozens of alternate takes, but he also has an ongoing title, you know, that keeps the character in the mainstream.
Right.
And has an ongoing story about him. Man-Thing shows up every 5 to 6 years. and maybe only for a cameo or a background role. So when you actually do a solo title on him or make him a main character in a book, you should really work with who the character is, because once you start doing alternate takes, you're not doing justice to who the character is.
Well, and when you reinvent a character like to such like an extreme, like in terms of extreme,
yeah.
That's the House of Ideas, where it goes so completely opposite of like the very nature of the character. Like Batman, you know, again, that can change. It could be a different person. You could even have a change of opinion. Batman could change his stance on a certain thing or what have you. And if you wrote it in a way that made sense and, you know, something has happened and so Bruce Wayne changes his opinion or Bruce Wayne retires and somebody else takes over, they're going to have their own perspective on things. That's fine because, you know, Batman is basically a cow and who's underneath it is interchangeable in some ways. I know we'll get potential kickback on that, but Man-Thing is Man-Thing. It's a very particular set of ideas, right?
Yeah. And the way that the comics, they usually use Man-Thing as a kind of a conduit to tell greater, broader stories, usually involving, you know, a social issue or an environmental issue or race or sexism or something like that. There were real ideas in that original comic book. There's crazy, fantastical weirdness going on in it, but there was always a point to it.
Right.
I think people get caught up in the double entendre of his name and they kind of miss what it's really about. And now it's just a swamp monster with a gun, which
that's kind of dumb.
Yeah, it is kind of dumb.
Kind of lazy because, and I guess we'll see how they treat the character, but it doesn't seem very respectful. Like you said, respectful of the character. You know way more about Man-Thing than I do. I just see the meaning. It's like, hey, and we're you know, it's like out of The Player. You know, remember the movie The Player, the Robert Altman film, and that first scene, that great tracking shot where they're in, you know, in a Hollywood studio lot, and you hear all of the different people discussing their ideas for movies. And, you know, that everything is a reference. Everything is like, well, you know, it's like Casablanca with, you know, with nuclear bombs. I'm making that up. But it's that sort of thing. It's like everybody's like, well, it's just like Casablanca with insert some silly idea.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I can kind of see a meaning here where whoever's writing this or what have you, the pitch is like, oh, yeah, you know, we're gonna take Man Thing and we're just going to give him a bunch of guns and machine guns and we're going to make him extreme and we're going to make him, you know, it seems like, you know, and then someone's like, oh yeah, just like, you know, like Venom or Carnage or.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing. They're kind of merging Venom with the Hulk and.
Right.
Yeah. And,
you know, in the same way that, you know, they change the Hulk, color of Hulk all the time. And it's like that's not really an idea. That's not really telling a story. That's just changing a visual.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, a couple of years ago, Man-Thing did have a limited series, you know, a solo title written by R.L. Stine. That was an alternate take on the character. And I didn't particularly care for it, but it's still kind of, I mean, you could tell that R.L. Stine was trying to be respectful to who the character was. He basically wrote Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
But for Man-Thing.
Right.
And, you know, which is the thing. I didn't, you know, Swamp Thing, Man-Thing. Let things be who they are. But, you know, like I said, I didn't really care for the R.L. Stine thing, but I did understand that he was attempting to be respectful and attempting to tell a good story. This one, I kind of don't see that. I kind of just see, like you just said, someone said, wouldn't it be cool if?
Right.
And didn't really, and they're not really thinking it through.
Now, there is a kind of a fun use of Man-Thing right now. I don't know if you're reading the Avengers currently or not, but, you know, Blade has a baby Man-Thing.
Yes, I'm so far behind in all my, you know, current reading. I know that it's there and I'll get to it, but.
Which in and of itself is, I don't know the history of how that came about because I don't read the Blade comics and I don't know if that's where it came from or not, but that's used actually to kind of comic and also interesting effect in the same way, like in Justice League, of all things.
Justice League is using Man-Thing? That's impressive.
Whereas in Justice League, you know, Batman has Jarro, which is, you know, baby Starro in a jar.
That sounds like a Ronco. New from Ronco, it's Jarro.
It's also interesting, like, how both of the major team books and two major companies feature a baby version or a kid version or a miniature version of.
Well, Baby Groot went over really well. So I think they're trying to make baby everything now.
Well, sure. And there was Baby Darkseid in Metal.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. It's Muppet Babies, but for superheroes. But seeing as how this, okay, so I'm not looking forward to manslaughter, which, you know what, as a character and just in general, not looking forward to manslaughter. So there are a lot of things going on in the world of X-Men. This got us to thinking, because I'm all right, so I lost track of X-Men for a long time.
We're switching topics.
We are switching topics. Or did I do that too quickly? So I kind of lost track with the whole X, with all the X books, and started picking it up through Hickman's run, which got us talking, Brian and I. And Brian, you said you've lost track of the X-Men characters a long time
ago. Right. Well, I stopped. I don't know. It's been a good 20 years or so.
I didn't realize it was that long. Goodness.
Yeah. It's I, at some point, it was, you know, I went to college. I had a limited amount of money, you know, for comics. And, you know, that's when Vertigo started to, you know, Sandman and stuff like that started. So, like, what money I had. And I also, you know, there were like 20 different X titles. I realize that's an exaggeration, but only a
small. No, it's not.
And so I just kind of like wandered away from the X-Men, you know, probably around the ages of, you know, 19, 20, 21. So possibly even more than 20 years ago. And the few attempts I have made to get back into the X-Men, it's so dense and it is so reliant. It just seems like X-Men is a very new reader, unfriendly title at this point. And, you know, the few, like I said, the few times I've tried to get back into X-Men, I was like, I don't know who half of these characters are. I don't know. They're referencing all this convoluted history all over the place. And I was like, there's no end for a new reader, or there's no new jumping on point, as you know, the parlance has it. And so I was kind of wondering and or hoping that, you know, because I love Jonathan Hickman. I love a lot of his work. I'm a big fan. And I was kind of hoping that, okay, you know, we were led to understand that he's resetting or rebooting. Rebooting, I know, is a dirty word. So let's say he's resetting the whole X-Men universe to make it more unified and more understandable, and to kind of get all of these loose threads tied up. But so I haven't started yet, because I think this is a point you were going to make about reading the trades. Maybe I should let you take over this point, then I will continue on once you make your point about reading the trade.
Yeah. Well, again, I am similar to you. I've actually read runs of X-Men more recent than 20 years ago. But it is a title that has so many titles and so many things going on about it. It's really hard for me to keep up. And I start just kind of, my eyes just start kind of glossing over, and I'm like, okay, I don't want to buy 9 books a month just to keep up with continuity.
Right.
So I let it drop as well. Now, when, again, I'm a fan of Hickman as well. When he started, when it was announced that he was going to be doing retooling, and I thought, great, that's a starting point. So I did start reading Power of X and House of X. And it becomes incredibly clear that as much as I like Jonathan Hickman, he reads better as a whole rather than just in little parts. Right. He's the kind of writer who plots way... There's a lot of intricacies going on in his plots.
Right, and you see that like in his independent comics, which is where he got his start, and you know, going into like a lot of his...
Oh, if you read his Fantastic Four and his Avengers, they're great comics, but they work so much better if you can read the whole thing together,
right?
You know, in one kind of complete storyline, and
which is frustrating sometimes. You
know, it is frustrating, and I got two.
Throws a bone to those who think comics should only be done in trades now, and you know, who are, you know, are singing the death knell of the the monthly floppies.
Well, this is let's clarify. I'm talking about one particular title from one particular writer,
right?
And I got, you know, I got two issues in to each, and I realized this is very, very good, but I want to read the whole thing. Yeah, I think it would work. I think it'll work better as a whole. So I stopped reading those, and I'm going to wait till the trades come out and just read the whole thing altogether. I do think it is a good starting point if you have at least a little bit of knowledge of the concept and some of the characters.
Right.
Yeah, there are things in it where I'm like, and who is that person? Don't know, let's move on. It does become clear after a while, which is why, again, I want to read the whole thing altogether.
Sure.
But yeah, I do think this is a jumping on point in a sense. You know, if you've never picked up a Marvel comic before in your life and you pick up Hickman's run so far, you
Hawks say... Pox. The kids are all calling it the Hawks Pox.
Hawks Pox?
Hawks Pox.
I had Hawkspox once. A little bit of penicillin cleared that right up. Yeah, so if you pick that up, I don't think you'd necessarily understand what was going on. But I do have a history. I've read Marvel comics before, and I have read X-Men specifically. So yes, I get it, and I can jump in. Even if there's a few concepts or a little bit of the history that I'm missing, I can pick it up.
Right, and I should clarify by me saying I haven't read the X-Men in X amount of time. that doesn't mean I'm not aware of some of the major goings-ons, you know, like I've talked about this before, and you referenced, you know, like with Man-Thing, it's like when one of your favorite characters is mistreated in a really terrible, horrible way, and what little I have read about or caught up on, and you know, how they're treating the Beast currently, has certainly caused me some agitation as one of my very favorite first favorite comic book heroes. But do you think so I do, you know, I feel like I could keep up in some ways, but I also, it's again, it's a limited amount of time, it's a little bit of a limited amount of brain space. that I have, you know, that I feel the same way with Spider-Man is, you know, now that there's 20 Spider-Man titles a month as well, that's hard to keep up with too. But do you think, like, so one of the common arguments about comics is it's now being written for adults. It's being written for people our age or, you know, slightly younger too. But do you feel that there's anything like, so when you're reading this Hoxpox, do you feel that there is anything in there that, you know, if we wanted to get kids back interested in comics, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. This isn't that argument. That's a different argument. But if an 8-year-old kid picked up X-Men right now, would they have any clue? Would there be any appeal or anything for an 8-year-old kid like when we first started reading comics?
Those are two different things, I'm going to say right now.
Right.
Would they have any clue? No. Would they have any interest? Yes. Now, just from my personal experience, comics in the old days, back in my day,
which is not the argument I'm trying to make.
No, but back in the day, comics were written as a serialized story, and story arcs could go for years and years.
Yes.
And it was just monthly, to the point, that's why comics back in the 70s had to have recaps every once in a while to say, oh, by the way, 2 years ago, this happened.
Such as the comic we're reading today.
Yeah, this one had to be, okay, 3 months ago, this happened.
Right.
And so when I was of, you know, of a certain age, I would simply pick up a comic. I've never read previous ones, but I was able to jump in and just say, okay, well, stuff happened. I'll figure it out along the way. And I think kids can do that. Yeah. So there isn't a, you know, quote, jumping on point in comics right now, but I think we should give kids a little bit more credit that they'll be able to just figure stuff out.
Well, sure. Kids are smarter now than we were when we were kids.
That's oh, absolutely. Plus, they got the internet. And if they have a question, they can say, huh, let me look up some history here.
Right.
You know, again, back in my day, I didn't have that. If I didn't know who a character was, I don't know. Run alongside or get left behind. That's basically it.
You either had the editor's note at the bottom, or occasionally you might be able to find, you know, the Marvel Comics, the history of the Marvel Comics, or the, you know, or the Who's Who.
Right.
I used to get the Who's Who when I was a kid.
Yeah, I always loved the little things at the bottom. He's referencing issue 27, folks. Like, okay, I have no idea
great.
How to...
So you go to your comic book store and the issue 27 or whatever they're referencing is, you know, on sale for $50.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that's where a lot of, you know, people of our generation, I think that's where a lot of our headcanon came from. Because
right.
We just made up backstories. You know, fine, I don't know who this person is, but I can imagine something. And then when you find out, inevitably when you find out who the real backstory, you know, like, oh, that's not as impressive as what I thought.
Right. And then that which of course led us to believing that we could write comics way better than these jokers writing them, you know, at the time. I mean, who is this Dennis O'Neill guy? I could write better than that guy.
And people like Denny O'Neill and other writers of his time.
That's a joke, folks. Dennis O'Neill is a fantastic comic book writer. Yeah. Anyway.
But those were writers who actually grew up reading comics and thinking, I can do this. And they did. But, you know, I think maybe, and I'm just speculating here, that's where the, you know, the toxic fandom is coming from.
Oh, yeah.
People make up their own headcanon. And when reality doesn't fit that, suddenly a gasket blows.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think these people also have difficulty with other realities outside of just comics as well. But yes, no, to your point, it's, we're treading over some familiar ground, but it's the expectations of what you think comics should be versus what they are.
Right.
And
enjoy something for what it is, not what you think it should be.
Right. You know, I love reading my old comics and I love, you know, sort of the nostalgia. It's like, I don't want new comics to be just like the comics I used to read. That's silly. You know,
No.
I don't want the movies I watch to be just like the movies I used to watch. I don't want the TV shows. And all of that, you know, it's like, I don't read the same book over and over. Well, maybe Ulysses, but other than that, I don't read the same book over and over and over and over and over again. I want new narratives and new writers and new takes on the human condition.
Yeah. And that being said, that old stuff doesn't go away. Right. For instance, I absolutely love and adore 70s comics. I have them. I can read them. But that doesn't mean I want everything now to be exactly like that. I can have both. You know, you can enjoy new things and still have the old stuff as well.
And one of the great joys of my life, just this past week when I was down south, and I stopped in a comic book store in Memphis, Tennessee, and I managed to score a copy of another copy of the Avengers, the one where they went on David Letterman.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, you know, and I've been kind of looking for that individual issue. It's a popular issue. It's not particularly valuable in any way, shape, or form. Not really, not in any serious way. But it is one that when people see it, I think they pick up. Yeah. And so, you know, for the past few years, I've been like, man, I'd like to get another copy of that. And I ran across it. It was like $5. And it made my day. It's not a very good comic. but it's a hell of a lot of fun.
It doesn't have to be a classic, as long as it's entertaining and you enjoy it.
Yeah.
Okay. On that note, that's what we'll be talking about on our main topic. Also, really quick before we go, Brian and I have been toying with the idea of taking requests.
Yes, we have.
For certain topics. So we're going to put that out there to everyone. If you have a particular run or story arc or character that you would like Brian and I to talk about, let us know on Twitter at CollectedEdPod. That's CollectedEdPod. So hit us up on Twitter. Let us know if there's something you want us to talk about. We can't guarantee that we will get to it, but I want to put it out there.
But I think it's a good idea because it might pique our interest in something that we haven't thought about yet.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, it's whether you really want to hear our particular take on a favorite arc of yours or not is another matter. But the perfect example is the part of the reason Paul brings this up, and we'll get this at the end of today's podcast. But our recommendation for the next podcast will actually be from a listener's request.
Yes. Yeah. So that's fun. Think about it, everybody, and let us know on Twitter. Okay. Yeah. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, The Living Mummy.
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a chemist named Ted Salas, until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing.
Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you, too, can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
And we're back! On today's exciting episode of the Collected Edition, we'll be discussing a favorite comic of Mr. Paul Carr's.
In September 1954, the Comic Book Code Authority was established. This was a self-regulatory organization that was created to combat juvenile delinquency caused by comic books that wasn't really happening. Among its many regulations of what could and could not be depicted in comics was the following guideline, and I quote, "Scenes dealing with, or instruments associated with, Walking Dead, torture, vampires and vampirism, ghouls, cannibalism, and werewolfism are prohibited," unquote. This, along with several other prohibitions on depictions of horror, all but ended the scary comic book for a generation. But in the 1970s, restrictions were eased a bit, allowing horror to come back to comics. Marvel was quick to capitalize on this and rushed into publication titles such as Tomb of Dracula, Werewolf by Night, Monster of Frankenstein, and of course, The Living Mummy. The Living Mummy first appeared in Supernatural Thrillers No. 5, but proved to be so popular that the character was brought back in issue 7 and stayed as the lead story in the book until its cancellation after issue number 15. The Living Mummy is an alternate take on the classic Universal Mummy films of the 1940s. Under the bandages, he is Nkatu, a chieftain of the Swahili tribe whose village was attacked and enslaved by Egyptians. Nkatu attempts to start a revolution to free his people, but is captured and as punishment given an alchemical preservative wrapped in papyrus and entombed for centuries as an undying preserved corpse, or a living mummy. Nkatu is revived in the 1970s and must first come to grips with his new environment, then battle elementals and supervillains and supernatural forces, and ultimately he must come to understand himself and his place in the modern world. Created by Steve Gerber and written at first by him and then later Tony Isabella, with suitably creepy art by Val Mayerik, The Living Mummy is an interesting and compelling glimpse into an industry that was just coming out of its own creative entombment and lumbering towards an unknown, uncertain future.
Huh.
So, Brian, what did you think of The Living Mummy?
Well done there in that that final sentence.
Oh, thank you. I'm a writer.
I'm a writer. Well, this was one heck of a read.
Okay. It's hard to encapsulate. I get that. It's
hard to encapsulate. I mean, it is an incredibly fun example of that genre, and it's very much in line with that sort of, because we've done, I think is this your third or fourth? Because we've done Tomb of Dracula.
Right.
Right. And we did Werewolf by Night.
No, we haven't done Werewolf by Night.
We haven't done Werewolf by Night.
We did Cap Wolf. That's what you're thinking.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we did Cap Wolf. And so now we're moving on to The Living Mummy.
Werewolf by Night did make an appearance in Cap Wolf.
Yes.
Remember, he gets on the motorcycle with the leather-clad fella.
Well, which is... Oh, that's right. Jack Terrier was in the Tomb of Dracula. So
Jack Terrier's Jack Russell. But he is a terrier. He's a terrier of the night.
Russell, the terrier of the night. But this reminds me of how much, again, I think we've discussed this before, but just how much 70s comics are... how entertaining some of these comics are. I would not, I think that this comic attempts some serious messaging a little bit underlying, actually in some ways not so underlying, and I'm not sure how well that works specifically within this genre, but the comic is a lot of fun.
Yes, it is. I like it. I think it's very much a time capsule into a certain period. Like I said, but the Comics Code is just kind of easing off. It hasn't been removed completely, not just yet, but it is easing off quite a bit. And creators are able to kind of flex their muscles a little bit and try new things. And that's what you see here. I think that's what you're talking about, where it's a little clumsy at times, but they're trying to address issues, a class, of race.
Right.
You know, they're really trying to get in there. But and they're really trying to tackle these subjects, but they haven't quite found their footing yet.
Right. And I think it's helpful that you have writers, the writers being Steve Gerber and Tony Isabella, two individuals who have not been afraid to address or tackle, let's say, issues of the day or deeper themes than what you might find in your normal sort of monthly comic.
Yeah, I mean, this is a time in comics where new ideas are being expressed and new directions. Comics get political, real political at this time. That doesn't happen anymore.
What? No, that's never happened until just now.
No, they did. They in fact get very political. So this Supernatural Thrillers was meant to be an anthology book. And it had retellings of The Invisible Man and retellings of The Headless Horseman and things like that. And then Gerber wrote this story, an original story about the Living Mummy, and it proved to be really popular. People wrote in and said, we'd like to hear more about this. They skipped one issue number 6, and then in 7, it came back as Supernatural Thrillers basically became The Living Mummy. It had the title Supernatural Thrillers really tiny, and then The Living Mummy huge,
right?
As was typical at that time. Oh, so first thing, I in the tease for the last episode in Swamp Thing, I said the art was done by Rich Buckler, which he did do the first appearance of the book, but it was drawn by Val Mayerik. So I should give Mr. Mayerik his due. So the first two issues were written by Steve Gerber, and then the rest were written by Tony Isabella. And there is a dramatic shift in tone and style when that does happen. Tony Isabella, he's much more of a, you know, kind of a straightforward comics writer, and he seems to want to make the Living Mummy into more of a superhero.
Right.
Whereas Gerber, he likes to dwell on the internal life of the comic. If you read the first two, it's very much about how Nkantu feels. He's you know, you get a lot of his internal brooding.
Basically. There's a lot of angst.
Yes. Whereas when Isabella takes over, it's a lot of him going, okay, I got to get out there. I got to do this.
And it immediately he's like, I have to save people because that's what I do as a former, you know, king or chieftain.
Right. And those, and especially the back half, these stories get very action heavy.
Right.
But you can see. All right. So first of all, I may have to gush about Gerber here for a little bit because I'm a big fan of because of the whole Man Thing connection. I'm a very big fan of Gerber. And he's a different kind of writer. He likes to infuse his stories with social commentary and fantastical elements. He has views and feelings on things, and he lets that be known. First of all, he makes Nkantu black, even though he's wrapped completely head to toe in bandages, and you know, it wouldn't on the surface matter, you know, what his race is. But it's there, and he puts that in there specifically so he can have confrontations with people.
Well, it's important to the character too. It's important to the development of the character because he and his tribe were basically kidnapped or, you know, enslaved by, yeah, by the Egyptians to build these pyramids. So he is coming from a sensibility of, you know, from being a slave or being a person who has been subjugated.
Exactly. And Antonio Isabella does that as well, but in a different way. The best example of that is the character of Ron McAllister,
right?
Who's an anthropology student. He's scared. He doesn't know how to fight. He's still pretty buff. you got to admit, but he's not a
fighter.
Yes, but he's not. Yeah, everybody. You
know, Foggy Nelson takes off his shirt and suddenly goes from a schlumpy guy to a guy with abs.
Exactly.
Everybody's so, yeah, a little buff in comics.
Right. So, but the idea is that he's a student. He doesn't know how to fight, but he wants to join in because he's doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
And it's an arc that Isabella is trying so hard to talk about, but it's never quite developed. And that's how war changes a person. It's a really interesting idea. I don't think that it's fleshed out enough to do justice to that.
Well, I think he did a decent enough job with that. I mean, obviously it was with limited. So most of this comic was half sized, right? So you had like 11 pages or 18 pages to deal with, as opposed to, what was it, 22 or 24 at the time? Because there was always a secondary story in these comics. These were almost anthology with a lead story and then, you know, a backup story that has nothing to do with the lead.
Yeah, and most of those backup stories were previously published stories. I don't know if you read those. I did read them. A lot of them were, you know, there was some Steve Ditko stuff in there and old Stanley, which is fun to read that stuff. But yeah, so a lot of information is being crammed in very, very quickly. At one point, even two pages of basically text in one issue.
That's always fun when that happens. TLDR.
But I do think, even though Gerber had a limited run on this, I think he really set the story going for him. He obviously created the character. He set it up. He put the elementals in place.
He prepared the menu and then let Tony Isabella, you know, sort of cook up what he could from.
Exactly. Another kind of a difference between the two is if you look at the origin of Nkantu, in Gerber's original, oh. Gerber's original, he was a slave. He's working as a slave. He's in chains and he's, you know, carrying heavy burdens and he's working for a long time as a slave and then rebels and leads his people to rise up and fight. He's captured and tortured and condemned. And it's a torment over a long period of time. In Isabella's retelling of that later in the series, you find him, he goes to his village, everybody's gone. He sees them being loaded onto a ship and immediately starts fighting and starts the rebellion right there. There's no real struggle. And it's just about, Gerber's mummy is about empathy. Isabella's mummy is about revenge. So it's just a kind of a couple of different viewpoints of how it's presented. It's significant, I think, of how the character is presented.
It's a less jarring though, because I think it's done later enough in Isabella's portion of the comics that if you're not going back and rereading, or if you're not reading.
Oh, at the time, you would not have noticed this at all.
Yeah, you wouldn't have remembered even.
Yeah.
It's also the question is how much of that was editorial at the time, how much of that was the author's choice, and who knows and who can ever tell.
Right. I'm picking this up because I'm reading them one after the other. You know, if I was reading this at the time, I'd read an issue and then, 6 months later, I wouldn't have remembered what happened back then.
Right. Hence all the origin pages.
Yes, there are some.
The recaps at the beginning of each issue.
But that's common for this era.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I do appreciate, like we were talking before, that they are really trying to make this significant. It's not just, they're not just relying on horror tropes, even though the artwork is very much, you know, of golden age horror comics. That's what it looks like. But that's not what the story is telling us. The one example I have is there's a brief scene where Nkantu is walking down a corridor and there's sarcophagus lining the hallway. And he talks to them. He tries to imagine what the Egyptians felt when they died. And did they believe Pharaoh was a god? Did they go willingly to their death? Were they sacrifices? And then he compares this to his own people fighting slavery. And that's the kind of thing that was going on at the time. It's very brief. It's very quick.
Right.
But it's really trying to put something deeper, a deeper meaning into, let's face it, what could be just a throwaway story.
Well, that's drawn out again in his battle with the elementals and how he views, you know, the Egyptian people he forgives the Egyptian people, you know, and at one point he says, this was 3,000 years ago. I'm not going to hold these people living now accountable for what was done to his people 3,000 years ago. But also at the same time, you know, he views with them, with the Egyptian people and the elementals attempting to enslave humanity eventually, but starting off in Cairo, where the majority of this comic takes place, you see that affect the living mummy's decisions going forward as well.
Yeah, I mean, and it should be noted that this whole thing, they're chasing the red scarab of MacGuffin. There's a jewel. The whole thing that sets this in motion is there's a magical jewel shaped like a scarab that's supposedly does something to do things that makes things happen.
None of which is made exactly clear, but it did affect the elementals.
The elementals say, "Oh, there it is. Let's go get this thing so that we can do our deal."
and it should surprise our leader, our listeners to learn that the elementals, of course, are, there's four of them, and one is an avatar of fire, and one is an avatar of wind, and one is an avatar of earth.
They're earth, wind, and fire.
Yes, they are.
And one can make water.
Yes.
There's something I just thought of. The avatar of wind, or the elemental of wind, at one point, there's a bunch of beggars, and she calls upon the winds of change. I laughed out loud when I saw that. That's her power, to call upon the winds of change. Do you remember the old Harvey Birdman?
Oh, cartoon? Yes.
Yeah. Well, remember he used to call upon the power of attorney. That's the first thing I thought of.
But this scarab apparently, like, so the elementals, correct me if I'm wrong, but they actually created the elements on Earth.
I found that to be a little unclear. Did they create the elements?
Right. But we were kind of like led to believe that, but it's sort of like, well, But eventually they got kicked off the Earth, and somehow the Red Scarab was involved.
Yes, the Red Scarab can... I didn't know if it was supposed to be it could bring them back, or...
Or restore their powers more fully, or it had the ability to take away their powers.
Yes.
I think that changes from panel to panel.
It's really up in the air. And again, I think they were hoping that, okay, no one's going to remember this in a couple of months. Everything will be fine. It was basically just a way...
Testing this on the internet in 50 years.
Exactly. It was basically just a way to have a through line through all these different stories to kind of to give it something to ground it upon.
To bring together disparate individuals into a quest and, the battle to... to bring into the war that shook the world. War that shook the world. But all of this, the Scarab is, like you said, kind of a MacGuffin.
It allows there to be a magical dome put over Cairo to kind of keep things contained. It's very interesting. Well, I guess not just, it's typical of this era of comics, but I guess it's typical of today as well. It is all integrated into the Marvel universe.
Right, because we have references to the Hulk, and we have references to the Avengers.
Yes. So this is all part of the Marvel Universe. But when you have a story like this, well, how come the Avengers don't show up? Well, I guess we'll just throw a dome over top of it, over top of the city, and everything's self-contained.
But it's also, there were various. So this is all, like, one of the things this comic does really well is they're talking pretty seriously about the Middle East and the problems existing in the Middle East at the time, and as we know, persist to this day. But part of why Egypt, like Cairo, can't get help from the Avengers and other parts of the world is because politics.
Yes, and of course, this is pre-Camp David, so things are pretty tense in that, area. Yeah, and again, that's another thing of the ideas being expressed, where they're really trying to not just ground it in reality. That's, there's earth, wind, and fire, so it's not really reality, but they really are trying to bring in issues of the day. And this was typical of Marvel across the board, being very political.
Yeah.
At the time. I mean, at this time, Captain America is going after the Secret Empire. It's the deep state.
Yes.
Yes. I really do find this era fascinating in that fact that the old guard is transitioning over, and these new writers are trying to infuse comics with their highfalutin ideals.
Right. This is very Marvel in some ways, because DC did not and still don't in some ways. Marvel certainly was more willing to touch on current events.
Yeah, this is all very new. So it's so the message is a little rushed, shoehorned, and clumsy at times.
Reflecting a little bit of a limited knowledge, it's because
there's a bit of naivete in there.
At the time, there was no sort of benefit of retrospect. So they're basically addressing what is known as opposed to what is really known.
There are known knowns and known unknowns.
Right.
But I do appreciate that they were trying, and they were, giving it their best college try. And I like it. It makes this, I find this much more compelling than just, if this was just a knockoff Boris Karloff kind of story, it would have been entertaining, but it wouldn't have been intriguing.
Right. I mean, they had to find some way to basically get this, the living mummy, to have a purpose other than, it's like those early Hulk stories where all he did was just jump about and, would randomly find themselves in, I leapt into this community by accident, and here's this thing going on, and I, the Hulk, will solve the problem, whether intentionally or not, and then I'm going to, bounce away to the next community. This was an attempt to give the living mummy a purpose to its existence and to it being a comic book that people would wish to read from issue to issue, which is very different, right, than a lot of some of the earlier horror comics, which again, like I said, we're kind of one and done.
Well, yeah, I mean, at this time, Marvel is really trying to expand it. Now, because you had something like Frankenstein's Monster, which had his own title, and it was, in the beginning, it was just a retelling of the Frankenstein the Mary Shelley story.
Right.
With using the universal, it used universal as a template, but it was basically just retelling the Frankenstein story. But other titles like Tomb of Dracula attempted to tell a different story using that character.
Well, they were using universal to tell universal.
I think, you know, because Tomb of Dracula is a great example because it that was allowed to develop over a very long period of time. That comic stayed for or at least 70. I think maybe it was 70 some. I don't know. Do research before you start talking, Paul. So, but I think because this is such a limited number of comics, had this been able to, you know, to grow and to continue, I think this is a character that could have expanded and become, and you know, it could have developed and become something kind of special. Because there's enough here in Kantu's backstory, the type of character he is, the empathy he's showing, he's starting, you know, Isabella's direction, he's becoming a hero, you know,
right,
a protector of sorts. You know, so had this been given enough time to evolve over time, this could have become something really kind of different, like Tomb of Dracula did.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it was canceled so quickly, I didn't get a chance to do that.
I mean, the plots are, you know, there's the plots of the story, which maybe we should have done it. You know, the first couple issues are kind of, right, the living mummy kind of wandering around, and he's, you know, we're being introduced to his later, and, you know, it does begin to coalesce. He has people helping him, and he's helping them. I think what half of these issues do involve, like, the battle with the elementals, which maybe goes on a bit longer than it should.
Right. Well, again, they were trying to kind of shoehorn in, or it seems that they were kind of shoehorn in their supervillain of the week, supervillain of the month. You know,
the same time telling a longer story.
Yeah. The living pharaoh is kind of a goofball of a villain.
who was a mutant, right? And had battled the X-Men. There's another connection too. So to
the greater Marvel world.
And the living pharaoh is the one who had the red scarab that had to be liberated.
There's just a hand that comes in under a curtain and zoink, it's all takes. I'll be taking this. Thank you very much.
All of this work, and you know, all you just see is a little hand reach under the curtain and take it away. There's, you know, the living mummy and the living pharaoh are battling each other. Oh, can I also just say real quick that having the relative
of the man who
of Nephrys, the high priest, who made the scarab, the relative now who is a good guy, and you know, the archaeologist looking for the scarab, his name is Dr. Scarab.
Yeah.
With a K.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know.
Although I don't know if you noticed in the lettering, sometimes the regular scarab would change to be spelled with a K, and sometimes Dr. Scarab would be spelled with a C.
It was a bit inconsistent.
But Dr. Scarab is looking for the scarab.
Yeah, I wonder if that was kind of a something that they regretted after a few panels. Like, maybe we should have named it something different. Too late. But yeah, I mean, we can talk about the plots. The plots are very, very simple overall. Again, in the Gerber stories, you get the living mummy sort of wandering around his environment and, you know, getting to know modern New York. And he's that fish out of water, mummy out of water.
Mummy out of sand.
Mummy out of sand. There you go. And, you know, and he's sort of meeting the locals and trying to figure things out. He's meeting up with
the
locals.
Hey, how's it going? I'm mummy.
Yeah, so that's a different, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see, like, if it had gone in that direction, how would the stories have developed? But it immediately changes gears and puts him into that. And that's, I think that's when Tony Isabella takes over.
Right.
And it becomes more action-heavy. Standard comic book fare. I'm not criticizing that, by the way.
Right.
That's very, very good. But
it would have been very interesting to see the living mummy loose on the streets of New York. And I mean, inevitably there would have been a crossover with Spider-Man because that's what you have to do.
Of course. Yeah, but you do get to see some Irvin jive talk with the living mummy.
Right.
Well, which is always just fun and awkward.
At the same time.
I can't remember how that went over at the time. I don't think I remember it being awkward, but it doesn't age well.
No, none of that does, though. And, you know, we've taught this, you know, from Power Man and Iron Fist to various other comics from the era. But I think it was an attempt to be hip, as opposed to, you know what I mean? It was like, you know, I'm a New York writer. I live in New York, and I'm writing, you know, the dialogue of New York.
Yes, I'm down with the youngsters, yo. I do think it's fun in an awkward kind of strange way.
Right.
But the plot's basically, it kind of escalates into using the Scarab MacGuffin and bringing in these supervillains. It's standard comic book fare. If it wasn't a mummy, you could easily put any superhero in that situation. It just makes it unique by having a, you know, ancient Egyptian mummy as your main protagonist.
And why not?
No. I think it's really unique and interesting. It's definitely a good experiment.
Well, I think it's a fun comic, and you know, it's certainly, especially the last half of it. You know, there's if you're in it for all the action, there is a ton of action. There's some touching moments too. I mean, there's that the Test of the Lion issue. Where it goes through kind of his origin of like part of his origin, his younger origin when he was younger, and he had to go out and he had to kill a lion to prove his worth as his father's son and someone who was going to take over the chieftain. And of course, then his story parallels, like after we get that, it parallels with a young woman from the Israel. I don't think it's explicitly stated that she's with the Israeli army, but you know, she is, who is being sent out to prove her worth before she can truly and properly take her place in the army as well. And of course, he aids her in this and even acts as a shield at one point. That's kind of a nice little story.
That really was well done.
Yeah.
As you mentioned. Yeah.
And it's not overly explicit. Like, you know, it's not didactic.
Right. Exactly. I would have. Yeah. So see, that's what I'm talking about. If this had been given some room to grow and more issues to expand the character, I think we would have seen more stories like that rather than the big epic spectacle.
Which I kind of get as well. It was jarring. It's like when the switch happened, I think, you know, we talk about the switch and we've mentioned it numerous times, but I think one of the most jarring aspects of it, of course, was, you know, I open up that comic when Isabella takes over and the mummy is in space. You know, where we go from New York and he runs into an alley and then the next issue we open it up and he's floating through space. That's like, what the heck is this? And, you know, it's the elementals trying to bring him to their planet that they've been exiled to.
This, which is jarring. But
I would read Living Mummy in Space comics.
Absolutely.
I would totally do that. Marvel, if you're listening.
Living Space Mummy.
Space.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
Yeah,
written by Jason Aaron, of course.
Isn't everything in Marvel written by Jason Aaron right now?
Well, Al Ewing.
Al Ewing. Okay, we have a few out. Yeah,
the only two writers currently working.
Now, there are definitely really interesting ideas being expressed here. For me, especially in the Gerber penned material, but Tony Isabella is a strong writer as well. And yes, and so had the Living Mummy been given some time to grow and expand, I think this could have been really. This would be a comic that we would look back, well, that I would look back on the same way I look at Tomb of Dracula and think, wow, what a great run of comics. You know, I think I would have looked back on this and considered it a classic. As it is, I think this is a good comic. I don't think it's a great comic, but it's compelling.
I think that's a fair assessment. This is not in any way, shape, or form a bad comic.
No, not at all. It's compelling and it has, it's a really fine example of the loosening of the chains, the easing of restrictions, the revival of an old genre of comics, and
the opening of the tomb.
Exactly. The experimental, and there's an experimental way creators are working with new material. It's a really great snapshot of a very specific time in comics.
Yeah. And it's a fun era too, is like, you know, seen like not just in this title, but in other titles as well. So.
Yeah. Everything's being thrown at the wall and seeing.
And it's a horror comic, right? You know, it's a mummy and this is Halloween.
Absolutely. It is the mummy.
Right.
I'm not doing that anymore. I'm going to stop that. Yes, I would recommend these. Well, I already have recommended it, but but I would say if you haven't read this, track it down, give it a shot. If nothing else, I think it'll give you a smile from time to time.
I feel like you could probably find these in quarter bins throughout the. I guess there are other ways for one to get their comics nowadays. It's been mentioned to me, other than just sorting through quarter bins, but. Or rifling through the regular back stock and, you know, finding a copy of the David Letterman issue of Avengers.
Yes, it's all very good. So unless you have more to say on this, I think this is a wrap.
I think it is.
Come on. It's a wrap.
It's a wrap. Oh.
Come on, man. I had that planned for you.
You want to try that again so it's you don't have to.
Oh, no. I think the groan says it all. Okay. So Brian, next time,
yes,
on an all new episode of the Collected Edition, what will we be reading?
Well, Paul, we will be reading a fan's recommendation.
Hooray!
Yes. So as we mentioned earlier, we are encouraging people to toss out ideas, story runs that they might want to hear us speak about in our rambling unplanned manner. this recommendation is coming from a coworker who is a regular listener of our podcast, and he had asked me one day, he's like, hey, how come you guys haven't done any 2000 AD yet? And I said, you know what, you're right, how come we haven't done any 2000 AD yet? And knowing that he is a massive fan of 2000 AD and Judge Dredd in particular, I said, Jeremy, what collected edition would you recommend we do? And Jeremy recommended Judge Dredd, The Cursed Earth, which I believe he feels is one of the more infamous runs in Judge Dredd. So The Cursed Earth features the writers Pat Mills and John Wagner and the artists Mike McMahon and Brian Stinkin' Boland.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes, indeed. So that's a hell of a lineup right there. Pat Mills, John Wagner, Mike McMahon, and Brian Boland. These stories ran, I believe, let me take a look just so I have the info right. I believe they ran in 2000 AD from issues number 61 to 85. Now, they're serialized, in the folks know how 2000 AD works. So it's not quite as overwhelming as it sounds. But this is also features a very famous couple of pages that were censored for a long time. So again, to clarify, this is a listener's recommendation. It is the Judge Dredd, The Cursed Earth.
That's cool. I am not familiar with a lot of Judge Dredd. I have read some comics, but not very much. So this will be great. I'm not going to dread reading these. No, it's something new for me, and I think this is exciting.
Yeah, I think, and particularly with the, like I said, with the creators, it's we'll find out if we can go wrong or not.
I believe, now correct me if I'm wrong, he is the law?
He is the law.
Okay, just making sure.
Yes.
All right, I think that's it. Thanks everybody for listening. And remember, you can send in your comments and feedback and recommendations. Go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes. You can also send us an email, comments@collectededitionpodcast.com, or go to Twitter, which is probably where you're going to go, which is @collectededpod. That's collected ED pod. We really would like your feedback. So please do that.
Indeed.
All right. So until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?